You're listening to Well Now, Slate's podcast on health and wellness. I'm Maya Feller.
And I'm Kavita Patel. About 9% of the U.S. population, which is just under 30 million people, may be diagnosed with an eating disorder at some point in their lives. And for decades, research into eating disorders focused overwhelmingly on cisgender girls and women. So many boys and men who also live with these disorders have faced a lack of care, resources, and support.
That's especially dangerous because eating disorders are more deadly than any psychiatric disorder except for opioid addiction. And the problem among males is growing. One study shows the number of boys and men hospitalized with eating disorders has increased more than 400% in the last two decades. But doctors' understanding of boys with eating disorders is evolving.
That's why today we're going to speak with a doctor who's become an expert on treating and recognizing eating disorders, especially for boys and men. But before we get to that, Maya, I'm curious to know if you've ever encountered patients with eating disorders in your work. I suspect you have, especially since nutrition is a key component. How, as a dietitian, have you gone about taking care of them?
That's a great question, Kavita. So I sit on two different interdisciplinary care teams, and I lead the nutrition portion of the care teams. And we work in conjunction with a psychiatrist, a therapist, as well as a primary care provider, and sometimes coaches who are on the ground with the patients. Now, the patients that we're seeing are pretty high needs patients, and they're actually we're replicating a medical model outside of a hospital setting. And so my job as the dietitian is to work with the families directly and talk to them about how to recreate the home environment around nourishment and what consistent nourishment looks like. And then the dietitian will actually go in and work on the ground with the patient. And these are pediatric patients that we're seeing. I have to say that, you know, it is not a linear journey. And so we often say that sometimes it's two steps forward, maybe a step to the left or the right, and a step backwards, but we're there to really create this care team that supports refeeding, right, and helping the pediatric patient actually eat on a regular and consistent basis and meet their nutrition needs while making sure that they stay stable. And I feel like in that work with those other care providers that we have pretty good outcomes. You know, it takes quite literally a village, I would say. The other group of people that we see quite often, Kavita, is adults with eating disorders. They present more and more. So people who are experiencing binge eating disorder, sometimes we have people who have anorexia, and I would say the longer that the eating disorder has been present, and this may be your experience as well, the harder it is to really treat because it has become kind of baked into the day-to-day. And from the nutrition perspective, we're really working on consistency and trying to help the people that we take care of not actually get worse or sicker. And we're trying to keep them out of the hospital. It's not easy, Kavita. It is really not easy. It is very complicated. What's been your experience?
Well, I'm going to be a little bit of a downer here because all my experiences come with people who have had, I would say, tragic kind of end consequences to severe eating disorders for some cases decades. So people with a woman in her 40s with pretty severe cardiac condition and kind of an electrical conducting condition known as atrial fibrillation caused entirely by her eating disorder, another patient and kidney failure on dialysis, again, from supplementation with creatine and protein to try to actually, you know, train and compete in like a muscle building environment. And then everything I can think of has been, unfortunately, like post-hospitalizations. And sadly, at that point, even though there is an interdisciplinary team, psychiatry, dietitians, you know, I'm an internal medicine doctor, endocrinologist, you name it, you name the specialty, you're really going into kind of crisis mode, not necessarily prevention, and certainly not what the title of our podcast is, wellness. And I think it's tragic. And I think that it's just getting worse. And I think that the conversation around boys and young men is not just so important, but, you know, I'll say this, shame on us for having the lack of like the guidance and treatment options and ability to access this until now, basically.
Yeah, Kavita, I agree. When I was working in the community, I felt like my patients that were coming in for the meals programs, many of them had eating disorders and no one was equipped to help them. And of course, they're the most marginalized and it just kind of went on with a hands up. Well, I guess the best we can do is offer breakfast, lunch, and dinner, but not more outside of that. That's a bit down too, huh?
It's okay. We don't, just because the title of our podcast is Well Now doesn't mean that we're only going to talk about the happy things, but I think here's what I am kind of optimistic about, that we're going to listen to our guest and we're going to be hearing about the very kind of front lines of research and guidance and hope that we haven't had for a long time.
That's right. All right. So let's bring another voice into this conversation. After the break, we'll speak with a doctor who's become an expert on treating eating disorders in boys and men. Stick around.
You're listening to Well Now from Slate. I'm Kavita Patel.
And I'm Maya Feller. This week, we're talking about the growing problem of eating disorders among boys. And our guest is Dr. Jason Nagata, who specializes in treating these patients. He's an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Nagata, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So we always like to start off each conversation with this question. And as Kavita says, it's not a gotcha. We just want to know what you think. How do you define wellness?
Oh, that's a great question. I think that wellness is not just, it's sort of the positive promotion of mental health and physical health in all different ways.
I love that. The positive promotion of physical and mental health in all different ways. All right, we'll take it.
I always kind of find that, especially as a physician, like there's so many things that like we don't actually get to talk about wellness. So it's kind of great to be able to say, what do you mean wellness? Like I only deal with sickness all day long. So it's that's why it really is a very kind of thought-provoking question. So, all right, Jason, I want to ask you, what is the biggest misconception about boys and men with eating disorders? And you can unpack that however you feel comfortable.
The general misconception about eating disorders overall is that it only affects females. And I think that this is because a vast majority of prior research and guidelines and media covering eating disorders has really focused on girls and women with a goal of thinness, which leads to weight loss behaviors. And so, you know, as medical and nutrition providers, we're trained to ask or screen for questions about restricting food intake, fasting, vomiting, all these behaviors that people engage in to lose weight. And I think that the biggest misconception is that, you know, boys have body image issues as well, but they may have different issues. And not all boys and men are trying to lose weight. Many of them may actually be trying to gain weight and build muscle. And the behaviors that they may engage in to achieve those goals may be very different than what we traditionally ask or screen for or think about as an eating disorder. So some of the patients that I take care of who have muscle dysmorphia, or it's also more colloquially known as bigorexia or reverse anorexia, they're doing everything they can to get large and muscular. And that may look like excessive or compulsive exercise. Some of my patients will exercise for like 7 hours a day, or, you know, using performance and appearance enhancing drugs like anabolic steroids. And there are dietary changes, but not just pure restriction. Often it's having high protein diets while cutting carbs and fats.
So Jason, could you tell us or define for us an eating disorder?
Yeah. So an eating disorder is technically it's a mental health diagnosis, but it does have many physical health repercussions. And I will say that the traditional eating disorder has had some body image component that leads to behaviors, like disordered eating behaviors, like what I had mentioned, like severe restriction or fasting or vomiting or taking diet pills to control one's weight. So there's some sort of body image disturbance as well as behaviors that can lead to impairment in functioning or poor quality of life and can have physical health consequences. I will say that's sort of a broad definition. There are many specific eating disorders that have very specific criteria. And I think there's also more acknowledgement now, although there's still a lot more work to be done, that there is a really wide diversity of eating disorders. And so while that's sort of the classic that people think about, there's also overeating disorders like binge eating disorder. There's actually now eating disorders that don't have a body image component, but are just really based on food preferences. There's a new diagnosis called avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. And so just to say, we're learning a lot more about it, and there's actually a lot of more diverse presentations of eating disorders than people are aware of.
And with this diversity and kind of what you described as conventional thoughts around how people present, why do you think cisgender, and I also would say probably queer boys as well, are underdiagnosed for eating disorders? And could you maybe share a story of a patient who'd previously gone undiagnosed because of these kind of gender and social, I'd say, norms?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, the way that I got into this field and interested in this research was one of the first patients that I cared for as a medical student was actually a 16-year-old male wrestler whose parents brought him into clinic because he was really struggling with his body image. And he had actually been struggling for years, but nobody really recognized it as an eating disorder, because I think, you know, in general, it's pretty normalized in wrestling that guys are going to be making weight cutoffs and doing kind of extreme, very similar behaviors, actually, that many people with eating disorders engage in to try to, you know, control their weight, to make specific weight cutoffs at specific times. And unfortunately for this patient, he had just done that, gone through so many cycles of that, that it really just became an obsession for him. And so he would weigh himself 10 times a day. You know, he had varsity wrestling practice for, you know, 2 to 3 hours a day, but all of his other free time was spent in the gym. So, you know, in addition to team practice, all of his waking hours, not in school, were basically at the gym working out. He started using anabolic steroids. He actually stopped eating with his family because he said, the food that mom is cooking is not high enough in protein. I can't have this. And so he would only eat, you know, eggs, whey protein, whatever. And he was kind of stopped even engaging in family meals. And so the parents brought him in, and, you know, given that he had been excessively exercising for so many hours every day, while he was still getting a high protein diet, it still wasn't enough to really, you know, match that, all the energy exertion that he was exerting. So he actually, when we first saw him, you know, had a dangerously low heart rate and a low blood pressure, and had actually some evidence of like liver dysfunction. And so he actually did have to be hospitalized. And I remember that as a student, trying to learn about this and provide him the best care, I was trying to read up the guidelines and what there is in textbooks. And at the time, there was basically nothing. All the research had been on female samples. At that time, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is sort of the Bible for mental health diagnoses, it actually required that you have a loss of periods, or the medical term is amenorrhea, to actually have a diagnosis of anorexia. So it just was very apparent to me that this was an area that like really needed a lot more research and guidance for providers, and also just more awareness for people, because, you know, he had really been suffering for years without ever being recognized. And I think that that sort of really shaped what I pursued in my career and in my research.
That's incredible. And by the way, those are such significant moments. I think all of us probably share them. Maya and I do too, like that kind of experience with a patient that really not just informed your career, but you kind of hang on to it. Like I've found that that like doesn't leave you. You mentioned the science, and I, by the way, that DSM, that kind of diagnoses, I remember that. And I remember kind of thinking, so I guess boys can't have eating disorders. I actually remember thinking that and having a conversation with one of the faculty that said, no, you know, we're working, like we're going to change these things. Like we know, but you know, it takes time. And I just remember thinking like that doesn't seem right. But how has the science kind of among understanding this changed? I know you've led some of those studies. Tell us about the science, the research, and what you're working on, what sparked those changes that we understand.
I will say that going forward from that first patient that I cared for in medical school, that really did inform all the studies that I kind of worked on. And my goal was really to, from the medical side, to really better understand what are the medical complications of eating disorders, specifically in male populations. So as you mentioned, we've actually looked at the past 10 years of data from UC San Francisco, where I practice, and have compared basically treatment and outcomes and different medical complications among males and females with eating disorders, and have found actually that overall, males have longer hospital stays than females. I think part of it is because they're diagnosed later. So oftentimes, like this patient, they present like sort of with some more severe complications. But also our treatment protocols are designed primarily for female samples. And actually growing teenage boys, especially those who are physically active, have greater energy and nutrition requirements than growing teenage girls. And so I think that we actually, when we're using hospital protocols that are based on females, we actually are under-treating, in terms of nutrition, the boys. So it takes longer for them to get to their goal nutrition because we're starting everyone at the same sort of amount and advancing by, you know, certain protocols that primarily were based on female samples. And then just looking at the different complications, we actually surprisingly did find that boys have greater heart rate abnormalities, higher rates of anemia, even higher rates of vitamin D deficiency than girls. And I think that may also partially reflect that boys are diagnosed later and may have different sort of presenting symptoms than girls. And so I will say that other than the DSM, there are like medical treatment guidelines. And that comes from the, at least for adolescents, it comes from the Society for Adolescent Health and Medicine. And I'm very actually proud that I was lucky enough to train during residency with the person who wrote those guidelines. And so I made a big deal about, like, you know, there are all these gaps and we need to fill where there are all these things that only apply to females. And so actually, I was able to get on the guidelines committee in 2022 and we updated them all. So at least for each set, there's like specific things for boys now. And so even though there's still a lot more that can be done, there's like, you know, still huge gaps. I think at least now in the guidelines, there's acknowledgement that there are these issues for boys and there are unique considerations. And so I think that was a big step.
We're going to take a break here, and then when we come back, more with Dr. Jason Nagata about treating boys and men with eating disorders. Stay tuned.
Welcome back. You're listening to Well Now. I'm Maya Feller.
And I'm Kavita Patel. We're continuing our conversation with Dr. Jason Nagata about treating boys with eating disorders. Jason, we've seen studies that show there's been a rise of diagnoses of eating disorders in boys and men. What are some of the reasons behind this rise?
Yeah, actually, there was a recent study that has found that hospitalizations for eating disorders by boys rose by 400% since 2002. And that's the demographic that really had the greatest rises. And I do think that eating disorders have complex causes. There's genetic, biologic, and social, cultural contributors. But I do think that in terms of social contributors, traditionally, peers and the media have been thought of as the biggest influences in people's body image. And I do think that in the last decade, one of the biggest changes has been the advent of social media, which is almost a perfect blend of the influence of peers and the media. You know, there's always been traditional media like television, movies. Well, not always, but, you know, at least for many decades before. But for the most part, young people were living in a read-only environment where you were looking at these images, but most teenagers in the 70s or 80s or 90s would not expect that they would be, you know, shown on a Hollywood movie or on television. But now with social media, anyone can produce their own content. And in fact, young people can get followings and likes and even advertising deals by gaining that influence. And so there's now more than ever this pressure to produce content rather than just consuming content. And I do think that that has led to a rise in body dissatisfaction and just pressures for young people and also constant comparisons with peers. I will say that similar to other trends we've discussed earlier, the vast majority of media has really focused on body image issues in girls and how social media has impacted that. But the few studies that have looked at boys actually have found kind of interesting findings. First, that male selfies are much more likely to be full body photos that show muscles as opposed to just their face. Girls are actually more likely to just focus on their face. And a majority of male body image related Instagram posts depict muscularity and leanness. And in terms of consumption, boys who engage with Instagram more are actually more likely to engage in disordered eating, meal skipping, and be dissatisfied with their own muscles, and even use anabolic steroids. So I do think that while they're relatively under-recognized compared to girls, social media does have an impact on boys in kind of unique ways. And I think that there is a little bit more awareness of eating disorder content on social media now, such that there are policies in place on many platforms that if people are promoting really overt disordered eating content, it can get flagged, although it's not perfect. But I will say there's not the same corollary for muscle building behaviors. So while some pure eating disorder content gets flagged and removed, none of the muscle building content right now gets removed because there's not that similar policy.
So Jason, let's actually talk about, I'll call it even beyond treatment, kind of is a very conventional word. It's so much more than like a prescription or an intervention or a treatment. It to me feels daunting, but let's talk about whether it's that first patient you remembered or anybody who's initially diagnosed with an eating disorder and they're in your office or you're seeing them in the, you know, hospital setting. Tell us what kind of the care management protocol looks like.
The first step is really identification and assessment and diagnosis. And so often the best place to start with that is in primary care, or primary pediatrician or family medicine provider who can, you know, do some initial screening questions and also potentially assess for labs or any other kind of medical complications. And they may then be able to refer a patient, if appropriate, to a specialized team. And I think right now, because eating disorders are so complex and multifactorial, the best evidence that we have is really that an interdisciplinary teamwork, so that somebody ideally has a mental health provider, a medical provider who can assess, you know, for labs and medical instability, and also a nutrition provider who can help specifically advise on the nutrition component, because that's such a big part of an eating disorder. And so really getting access to an interdisciplinary team that can work together to support these various aspects of an individual. And I think going back to this definition of well-being, I think there are obviously physical health and mental health are linked in ways that it's hard to tease out. But I do think that specifically with eating disorders, they're one of the conditions that really have significant consequences in both the mental health side and the physical health side that really need specialists in both areas.
Yeah, Jason, it's so interesting that you talk about that interdisciplinary care team, because I sit on a few interdisciplinary care teams where I'm the dietitian, and then we've got a dietitian that works with patients, and then there's a psychiatrist plus a therapist and a doctor. And you're right, it is a massive effort on the part of everyone that's involved in taking care of that particular child. No easy feat. So as you're working with your patients, how are you helping them to, I'd say in particular, reframe their relationship with how they perceive their body as well as how they interact with food?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I guess I will also say the caveat that because I'm really fortunate to work at an interdisciplinary specialty center, you know, my component is really the medical side. And so what I do day to day is really, you know, checking labs and vital signs and managing that. And so actually, I'm fortunate that we on our team have, you know, specialists who really focus on therapy and, you know, the mental health aspects of an eating disorder. I will just say from a broad stroke, there's actually different approaches. Very generally, I will say that the first approach is for a minor, someone who's like an adolescent who's still living with their parents. Actually, the first line treatment is family-based treatment. And actually, one of the first studies to really look at this specifically in boys is just coming out this month and does show that family-based treatment has efficacy even in boys. This, I think it's the first study that I know of that actually looks at this specifically in the boy sample. All the previous research has been in girls, but it seems like this approach, at least for minors, works. And so while there is certainly a component of getting the adolescent themselves to be more accepting of their own body, and there's also an acknowledgement that for minors in particular, some adolescents, you know, they're going to be more sensitive to these issues, and they may not, especially if they're really in the throes of an eating disorder, they may not actually have insight to be able to turn themselves around. So it really is up to the parents as well to support them, to supervise them. And I do think that if you are able to really get the whole family unit to support an individual, and in some ways that does especially for people who are so malnourished or so severe that one of the consequences of severe malnutrition is that actually it can, you know, there's actually evidence of even structural brain changes. And so an individual who's malnourished sometimes can't really think rationally because, you know, their body is just in a starvation state. And so sometimes we actually really do rely on the parents, even if that child is kicking and screaming and doesn't want to eat, like to really support their child to get what they need.
And as a primary care provider, Jason, as you talk, I'm thinking, yeah, I probably don't do a very good job. And I'm not sure I even had the training to recognize some of what you have been describing, doing research on, implementing in guidance and guideline changes. What can be done to kind of better care for these patients? What can we be doing better? And how would you talk to primary care doctors about being trained in this?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that there's generally pretty limited training for eating disorders in general in medical schools and in primary care training settings. And then there's even less, you can imagine, specifically in boys, men, and kind of more diverse gender populations. I will say that the screening tools that have been developed and validated are really still reflective of this thinness-oriented goal. And so the few screeners that we have that are most used in primary care really are limited to looking at the restrictive eating behaviors. And so it does a fair job at assessing for anorexia nervosa or bulimia nervosa, but these don't really capture some of these muscle building goals that I've mentioned earlier, or even the excessive exercise. And so I think the first step is to really develop assessment tools that are more inclusive of diverse genders and actually of diversity across many different spectrum. I think that eating disorders still have a stereotype that they affect primarily affluent white women who are thin. And I think all of those things are stereotypes and not actually true. Like, eating disorders can affect people of all body sizes, of all races, ethnicities, of all socioeconomic backgrounds, of all genders, all sexual orientations. And I think that the tools that we have for assessment and screening are still focused more on thinness and girls particularly. There was actually a recent review of all this literature for screening from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, which is sort of this organization that looks at all types of screening and makes recommendations whether screening is effective or not. They actually said for the first time they reviewed eating disorder screening 2 years ago, and they made the conclusion that there just wasn't enough evidence to recommend or not recommend. And the reason why was that the screening tools were not diverse enough, or they didn't capture enough diversity.
I also wonder too, Jason, you're talking about these stereotypes, and I think that they actually jump over into the personal sphere, like that family kind of circle. So I think families also believe that anorexia is for thin young girls. And I often find when I'm working, and especially with that family, because I do the nutrition counseling for the parents, that they say, no, our child does not really have an eating disorder, right? Because it doesn't fit that they're trying to be thin and it's not a girl. So how do they wrap their heads around that? So for you, if you have a parent who doesn't have a child that has a diagnosis yet, but they're worried about the possibility that an eating disorder may be present, what would be the signs that you would tell them to look for?
In general, warning signs, particularly for boys, occur when this individual develops preoccupations or even obsessions with appearance, weight, food, or exercise in a way that really worsens their quality of life and impairs their social, school, or daily functioning. So as I mentioned, even with that first patient, like an example is if they're spending all of their awake time exercising or thinking about exercising, and then they feel guilty if they're not doing that in a way that really worsens their quality of life and affects their social relationships and or functioning. Those are all general warning signs. And I will say, though, that it is complex and it is a spectrum. And so I don't want people to think that just because my son is exercising, like everyone has an eating disorder. Actually, studies that we've looked at across the U.S. find that a third of teenage boys are actively trying to gain weight and bulk up in like high school boys. So it's really common, actually. I think it's much less, people don't necessarily recognize that boys actually have pretty active body image goals that they're trying to achieve. Now, not a third of teenage boys across the US have an eating disorder. And, you know, to some extent, exercise, physical activity in moderation is good for your health and good for your well-being. But for a subset of those people, it starts to really weigh in on their mental health, and it feels guilty if they're not doing it, and it becomes an obsession. I think when it tips over to the obsession that really it's not getting mental health benefit, but it's actually leading to more distress and preoccupation and obsession, that's sort of when it, to me, tips over to a disorder.
And when the families see their sons tipping into that disorder, saying things like, the meals that you prepare no longer fit with my goals, or I can't attend X function because I've got to stick to my exercise routine, what should those families do? Or even, it doesn't even have to be the family, but like the people in the general community that are close to those family members, like, you know, what should they do?
Yeah. I mean, I do think that it's complex and probably depends on your relationship with the individual. But I do think that if you are worried, having open lines of communication to express some of those concerns and potentially providing some resources, if they do have access to a primary care provider or somebody who can they can initially talk to, I do think that because there's so much diversity, really individualized care is the best. But, you know, short of that, there are resources also, like the National Eating Disorder Association has resources, and there are many similar organizations that have helplines that you can at least have an initial sense. But I do think that I'm at the point that it is more likely that somebody has an eating disorder. I do think that more individualized treatment and care is the best way to go.
I've heard from some of my patients that, you know, when they go in for primary care, that as you both have talked about, I mean, we've been talking about today, that the with the young boys, that the pediatricians really miss the diagnoses. And I feel like in this era of wanting kids to slim down, there's a huge discussion around that. How do we reframe the discussion so that it, you know, we're not actually inciting disordered behaviors when we're talking to kids in primary care settings or health settings in general, even in schools, right? These discussions come early, Jason. I've been in schools where they have nutrition programs that start in kindergarten. And some of the language is, from my perspective, questionable, right? About really creating like binary thinking around food and physical activity. You know, how do we help to reframe that with this thinking that eating disorders are pervasive regardless of the individual?
Yeah, I think that that's a really great question. And one thing that it's shocking to hear about this kindergarten thing, but it's not surprising actually, because actually one of the studies that we looked at found that actually boys' action figures in the last 30 years have significantly become more muscular. And if you think about the age of kids who are playing with action figures, those influences start at a very early age now. And as you mentioned, even with health classes. And so I do think that some of these exposures happen quite early. And I do think that to some extent, a more training in the medical community is needed, because I do think that the traditional, like there's definitely much more training in medical school about obesity and obesity management based on body mass index, which is, you know, just based on your weight and height. I think that it's pretty common for medical practices to, you know, have easy screening for that. And if somebody is flagged as obesity, then it, you know, becomes an official problem or diagnosis. And medical providers are trained to encourage people to lose weight, essentially. I think it's getting better, but I think what we have sometimes seen is that there will be, say, a child who's flagged as being obese. There's some recommendation to lose weight or change behaviors. And then in busy primary care, it's like, okay, we'll see you next year or whatever. And then where we get referrals is then the next year, an individual comes and lo and behold, they've lost like 50 or 100 pounds. They're now malnourished. They have all these complications. And basically, there was like a see you next time. And then it, you know, all of a sudden has gotten out of control. Now, that's not the case for everyone, but there are select people that I would say that that's a common way that people get referred to our eating disorder clinic. And so I do think that if people are going to recommend or try weight loss, which I think in itself is a little bit controversial, you know, making sure that you do follow up very closely and that you give very clear guidance, and also flagging what kind of behaviors really should be dissuaded or are not safe, and to really have close monitoring, because I think that young adults or adolescents, sometimes they're not really seen by very frequently but by medical providers. And so a lot can happen in a year or two.
Dr. Jason Nagata is an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of California, San Francisco. Jason, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me and for raising awareness about this important topic.
If you want more information about eating disorders, visit the National Eating Disorders Association website at nationaleatingdisorders.org.
And that's Well Now for this week. Our show is produced by Vic Whitley-Berry. Ben Richmond is Slate's Senior Director of Podcast Operations. And Alicia Montgomery is Slate's Vice President of Audio.
If you have something you'd like us to cover, email the show at wellnow@slate.com. And be sure to follow us everywhere you listen to podcasts so you don't miss an episode. Join us next Wednesday for another conversation on health and wellness. I'm Maya Feller.
And I'm Kavita Patel. Thanks for listening.